So the Gemara here, or the Mishnah rather, begins, Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana, Hayamit Palo, Bechnisatu, Beit HaMidrash, Uvitziyatu, Tfila Katzara. He would daven a short tfila. And then before telling us what the tfila is, actually, we already see that it's kind of ruffling some feathers. It's maybe not so intuitive exactly what this tfila is meant to be, because he gets challenged. The Mishnah continues, Amrulo, Ma Makom L'tfila Zo. What's the place of this tfila? That is always kind of a weird phrase. What's the place of it? It seems like fellow rabbis in the Beit Midrash. It's not telling us who they are. So it happens to be Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana is a fairly early Tana. I think he's a second generation Tana. So not many people who are preceding him, but could have been a peer or a student. And it seems a little bit incredulous. Like, I'm not really sure what you're doing here with this tefillah. And some of the commentaries say, Ma makom l'tfila zo, means what's the nature of this prayer, right? What is the idea of it? And then his answer makes a lot of sense. His answer is, well, here are the main ideas I'm trying to touch on. He says, Amar lahem b'chnisati ani mitpalel shelo ye'era davar takala al yadi. I pray when I enter the Beit Midrash that nothing bad, that no mistake should happen because of me, no mistake presumably in learning or in halachic ruling. And when I leave, uvitziyati ani notin hoda chalkei. When I leave, I give thanks for my portion in Torah, for my ability to participate in the study of Torah. It's a privilege. It seems to it's interesting. He doesn't talk about enjoying it. He doesn't say it's so fun, but at the very least, he appreciates its value. I don't know in the actual substance of the tefillah. Even there, it doesn't say, it sounds like he's excited for it, but it doesn't sound like he's necessarily enjoying it here. The idea of enjoying Torah.
This tefillah loudly, correct? Otherwise,
how would they have noticed? Maybe he's, entered the room and then was sitting right by the entrance and started mumbling something. And when you watch a rabbi mumbling something, you know that's got to be religiously important. That could be as well. The Gemara goes on to actually give you a text of these tefillot, and they're different versions that have different Rishonim quote, but very briefly. And I think it's worth looking at it to see how the themes of the tefillot get explicated in the text, and that's going to be important for us in a little bit. So the Gemara begins with a Breita, Tanu Rabbanan, Bechnisato Mahu Omer. What does he say when you enter? And here's, open quotes. Yiratzon Lofanecha, Hashem Elokai, may it be your will, Shelo Ye'ara Davar Takala Al Yadi. And now, let's expand on that. That was the quote from the Mishnah, but I guess elaborated. Velo ekashel bedvar halacha, I won't make a mistake in learning in a halachic matter. I don't know if this would apply to more philosophical or parshanut matters. V'yismuchu b'chaverai, and the others in the Beit Midrash will rejoice at that. They'll be happy that I made a mistake, and that would be bad for both for me, I don't want people to make fun of me, and for them, because they'll have done something wrong. And similarly, velo omar al davar tameh tahor val davar Tahor Tameh, I won't make an actual substantive error, meaning I won't issue a factually incorrect ruling that would have negative consequences for other people. And velo yikashlu chaverai bidvar halacha ve'asmach behem. And my friends, my fellows in the Beit Midrash won't make mistakes that I laugh at them for, presumably the inverse reason. They'll be hurt, and then I'll have, committed an error that I might be punished for. And when he leaves, he uses the language that should be very familiar to us, because it's very similar to the language when a siyum is made. Moda ani lefanecha, says the Gemara, I thank you, Hashem, Hashem Elokai, shesamta chalkim yoshvei Beit HaMidrash, you placed my portion here in the Beit Midrash, velo samta chalkim yoshvei kranot, among the idlers, or the batlanim, the people who kind of waste their time, sit on the street corners, and bum around. And then he draws several contrasts between himself and them. Ani mashkim, vehem mashkimim. I get up, but I get up to learn Torah, and they get up to do useless things. I work and they work, but I work to do useful things, and I work and receive reward, they work and they don't receive reward. I run and they run, but I run to Olam Haba, and they run to the Be'er Shachat, basically to their own deaths.
And this is the same language that we use.
Very similar to the part of the Siyum. Siyum has more here, but this definitely fits with the theme of the Siyum, which is a little bit interesting. So we're going to try to tackle two questions today with the time that we have. The first question we're going to try to tackle is this prayer obligatory or not? Right? When you first read the Gemara, what was your intuition? Did you think this prayer would be something that you had to say, that it was a choice? I see a head shaking, right? You thought, no, Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana, this is fine for you. I don't have to listen.
The people who listened to it didn't say it.
Maybe until he taught them, though. once he taught them, surely they all jumped on board. It doesn't say so, correct. Did anyone read this and think, oh, this is a paradigm, right? This is something I meant to follow?
Well, there was a question raised later on because Shem Hashem is not mentioned at all.
That's true, and that might affect how we understand this prayer. So that's actually going to be the second question we'll look at is, first of all, is this obligatory? Do we have to say this or not? And maybe under what circumstances should it be said? And number two is, what is actually the nature of a prayer like this? And how does it fit, I guess, more broadly with the tefillot that we've been learning about until now? Right? We've been learning about Shacharit, Mincha, Maariv, Musaf. This is obviously not exactly the same, but in what ways is it different? Or how does it relate to those other tefillot? So let's get started with some of the Makor. We start looking at the Rishonim for our first question. Is this obligatory or not?
One question. Because,
yeah.
Like in Ezekiel, the thing that he says, even though we say it assumes, it's so down on other people. You know, he's saying, I'm really, I'm the guy, and everyone else is crap.
So is your question...
Very negative philosophy.
Yeah, so it's definitely harsh, right? If you were a Yoshev Kronot and you were listening to this, you'd probably hurt your feelings. You wouldn't be necessarily so happy. There would be two ways to ask your question, right? One is it arrogant of you to say, yes, I'm really great? And that could be or not, meaning at the end of the day, these are my choices. So I'm not thanking Hashem that I am a huge, genius and I've memorized all of Torah. I'm thanking Hashem for giving me the ability to participate in this way that I've chosen to do. And the second is the tone, right? Is it or under what circumstances should we be, I guess, disparaging to people who are not behaving and living appropriately?
And he's doing it in the base medrash in front of his friends.
Right, meaning the Yoshevei Kronot probably aren't hearing him.
No, but the guys in the base medrash, if someone came into this base medrash and said that, you'd think, I don't know if I want to be with this couple or something.
Or maybe you'd feel, wow, I'm so great, because look at me in the Beit Midrash with all these other people. Right. So it's hard to know which way to go.
I think that speaks to the point of the question, right? Ma makom b'tfilah zo, right? What kind of place is this, the Beit Midrash? Why do you need a kind of tfilah like that? I think that question gives the answer of, because when you're in the Beit Midrash, you have to be aware of the other possibilities, right? That I could just as easily be spending my time on dvarim b'teilim, on like nonsense and things of not consequence, right? Or inconsequential, right? So it could be, like, one sense is to look at it at them, but I think if you look at it through the mirror, Rabbi Nachmanja ben Hakana might also have been saying, it's so easy for me to be like that I need to be in the Midrash to remind myself of all of the important values and things that I should be spending my time with. So it sort of flips it that way.
Right, and that picks up on that sort of odd word, right? Makom. Like, what are we talking about place here? But it's actually when you encounter this environment, that might inspire a certain kind of thinking, which might be important. Okay, so to the question of the authority of this tefillah. So this seems, based on the sources on page number 4, to be a machloket rishonim, pretty straightforward between the Ritva in source number 1 and Rambam in source number 2, right? Ritva says, quotes the Mishnah, Rukhuna Menachana, Aidi da Airi Me'inyan Tefillah, while we're talking about prayer anyway in the Mishnayot, right, we were talking about the timing for Shacharit and Mincha and Maariv and Musaf, so while we're talking about Tefillah, Aiti ha Tefillah hacha, we'll throw in another Tefillah here. This is another prayer, kind of goes with the rest of them. But, he's very particular to say, lo nafgalan midi, there's nothing authoritative here, right? A nafgamina is something that comes down as like an authoritative halachic ruling or a consequence of another halachic claim. Here, nothing authoritative comes. All this is teaching you, v'ashmeinan, demisha rutza lomer hachi harshis biado, that if you want to say this, you can. So we already said some of the advantages of this interpretation, right? Rabbi Dechuni ben Akana is being described as saying this. He's not proclaiming the one who enters the Beit Midrash ought to do this. He's just saying that he did it. He's being described as a personal practice. There's no form of tefillah here. It's one-liner. We don't even know what the text is going to be. So there are some good reasons to think that this might not be obligatory. What would be the logic, on the surface, at least, for saying that it should be obligatory? So it's kind of the implicit question the Ritva isn't answering but is alluding to. He's saying, this tefillah is mentioned here because we're already talking about tefillah. It already kind of suggests a question, which is, but what is this really doing here? Right? If this is the chapter of Shacharis, Mincha, Maariv, Musaf, so a tefillah like this doesn't really belong. And in fact, in the ninth parak of Brachot in the Mishnayot, you have all of these more situational kinds of prayers. So what is it doing here? So one might answer that question by saying it's here because just like those other prayers are obligatory, this one is obligatory too. And that might be sort of a counterfactor for the Ritzvah, how you might get to something closer to the view of the Rambam. And in fact, the Rambam, source number 2, says explicitly, Shtei tefilot elu chova al kol misha nechnas lebet ha-midrash lelamod. They're obligatory for anyone who goes to learn. And he tries to infer this from a particular turn of phrase in the Mishnah. Halo tira, shalo amar bechnisato mahaya omer. It doesn't say what would he say or what did he say. Rather, it uses a different language. Ela amar bechnisato, I skipped one line, mahu omer. What would or should he have said? Which the Rambam thinks that the difference between the word mahaya omer and mahu omer is the difference between a description of a personal practice and a legal claim that you ought to do this. It would be proper to do so. And because of the choice of language, Rambam concludes that it is obligatory, and this seems to be the majority view that you see in the Rishonim. A lot of Rishonim quote the view of the Rambam, either explicitly or implicitly, and the Shulchan Aruch even rules this a halacha as well, that a person ought to say this tefillah. He doesn't use exactly the word chova, but he's borrowing the language of the Rambam, which makes it seem like he is following that position as well. But the Rambam is quick to note that even though it is obligatory in his view, and maybe that's why it fits in these Mishnayot, still there are important differences between this tefillah and, I guess, a standard kind of prayer. And he mentions those in the second paragraph on source number 2. V'yesh lo l'gpal shtei tefillot elu, bein omed, bein yoshev, oeich sheyiyah. You can stand, you can sit, whatever position you want to be in, which we know is not true for many tefillot. You stand for Shemona Esrei, maybe you sit for Kriyat Shema. Nope, here you do it however you want. What?
Right,
that's true. Even the idea of, I think standing for an Esrei, I think is pretty universal, but you're right, in some other areas it might be a little bit more fluid.
So how come for this prayer, there's no one to debate? You know, when you get to Elokai Nitzar, or Modim, and Modim to Rabbanim, there's all kinds of other versions. This rabbi said it this way, this rabbi said it this way, we choose to do this one. Here, all of a sudden, this guy comes out of nowhere, he says, yeah, what are you mumbling? This is what I say when I come in, this is what I say when I leave. It's a nice thing to say, but all of a sudden it's halacha. No other rabbi ever said anything similar spirit, but different wording that might have been better. It's not introduced anywhere.
So, if I'm understanding your question correctly, right, you're saying this is basically presented as a single person's practice,
yeah.
And even the text is sort of a single person's text, and even if we like the idea, who says we should borrow the exact form that he used? So I think there are probably two ways to sort of respond to that question for Rambam, right? First is, this isn't like some statement somewhere. This is a Mishnah. This is a pretty central positioning for an idea like this. It's not like a fringe comment that gets made once. It really is sort of put front and center. And the second point is that it's actually not so clear that exactly this text is preserved. If you were to open, a lot of Gemaras have this on the inside front cover, these tefillot printed, and the word, the terminology or the exact text varies from version to version. Some of the Achronim quote, for example, the Arizal, that maybe had a more mystically inclined text that was also different. So you have different texts that get developed, which maybe suggests some of the fluidity that you might have been hoping to find. Even if it's not explicit in the Gemara, that should be the case.
Why are you making such a big deal? If it's not with a bracha, we're done.
I'm sorry?
Why are we making such a big deal? If it's not with a bracha, he's not doing anything with a bracha, we're done.
Well, here's the, I mean, the big deal is whether I'm obligated to say it or not, right? If I go to the Beit Midrash every day, which, thank God, I'm blessed to be in the kolal here, I come here most days, I don't say this tefillah when I walk in, I'm missing some mitzvah. I don't know if it's, you know, biblical or rabbinic, you could work out whatever problem it is, but it's important that I get it right. But you're right, it's definitely a much more fluid kind of tefillah, and Rambam goes on to identify all the differences. You could do it in any position you want, you don't have to face directly to Yerushalayim, you don't make a bracha, you don't bow. All of these differences kind of suggest that it's not a real tefillah. And why is it called tefillah, says the Rambam, in the end of that section? Because anytime you request something, it's called a tefillah. So I'm requesting help from Hashem to improve my learning, and that is a tefillah. That's sort of a very generic use of the term. It's really a very different from all kinds of other tefillot.
And this last statement tells you that a little negative
I'm not sure negative.
Did
I think
he say himself.
At the very least, he thinks you're obligated to do so. I don't know that there's any record of I watched the Rambam walk into the Beit Midrash and recorded him. Exactly right. I think he would say it's a obligatory request, but just not one that has the same formal structure, right? If we were, you know, in maybe more of like a theoretical learning context, you might use the phrase a chafta of tefillah, like a literal like object of prayer. That is, in the formal sense, a piece of tefillah that we're used to from our shacharit and mincha and ma'ariv. Those are much more formal, much more regulated, more rigorous rules. Here, it's much more fluid, but you would have to do that thing. The Rambam, notably, puts this halacha not in Hilchot Tefillah, in the Mishneh Torah. This is one of those places where categorization can sometimes matter. When the Rambam puts this in source number 3 into his magnum opus, he puts it in Hilchot Brachot, because it's not a tefillah, it's sort of an extra prayer. And he says at the beginning of this chapter, Perek Yud, this is where I'm going to put all of the extra requests and brachot, and he even uses the words even less committal. It's brachot achirot, other blessings, udvarim, and even other things that you say. And if you go through this chapter, you see lots of examples of many miscellaneous brachot. The bracha on seeing 600,000 Jews, the bracha on seeing unusual creatures or particularly beautiful creatures, the brachot on seeing different parts of the land of Israel or different parts of the world, Yom HaMelech, things like that. Those are all included in this parak. And then towards the end of the parak, he just starts talking about other, you know, yehi ratzon, other little requests that you can make. So he had a yehi ratzon for when you go for bloodletting, which is he thought was a good medical decision. So you have a tefillah that the bloodletting should be a productive session of bloodletting. That was one tefillah that some suggested when you get treated for COVID that came up in that discussion as well. Maybe you should recite some version of that tefillah, which is interesting. And then towards the end of the chapter, he lists these tefillah. When you enter the Beit Midrash and leave the Beit Midrash, and his girsa, his version of the text, is slightly different than what we have in our Gemara, but he sort of introduces it here. And the guiding principle is not the principle of tefillah, but what he summarizes in Halacha Chavav, the end of that chapter, which is this general rule. Klalo shel davar, the general rule, La'olam yitzak adam al ha'atid lavo vivakesh rachamim. A person should always call out to Hashem on what could happen in the future and ask for help. And v'yitain hodaya al sha'avar v'yoda v'yishabeach kefikocho. And thank Hashem for what came in the past, ask Hashem for help on what comes in the future, praise Hashem and thank Him and honor Him. V'chol amar belehodot et Hashem l'shabcho tamid harizah meshubach. Anyone who does this more, or even constantly, tamid, it's praiseworthy. Harizah meshubach, it's better to do this more. So these tefillot are obligatory, but they're not obligatory in the way that I'm legislating this particular recitation at this particular time in this particular way might be obligatory. It's obligatory as part of a general religious disposition, the disposition of being appreciative and thankful and recognizing that you need Hashem's help and that Hashem has given you His help many times. And then you do the general driving principle for this Rambam, but it's not a musar, right? It's a halacha. It's in the Mishneh Torah. He calls it a chova. These are real authoritative rulings, even though it might sound just like a sort of nice idea. So if it's obligatory, and if most of the Rishonim follow this view of the Rambam, why don't we say it? And it sounds from the Mishneh Berurah, source number 4, that we won't read inside in the interest of time, that he thinks it's obligatory. But the Aruch HaShulchan, source number 5, suggests that we may be misunderstanding the scope of the tefillah. That this tefillah really seems much more applicable not to individuals who are learning, but to halakhic authorities. After all, this tefillah was, may I not make any mistakes in halakhic ruling that could trip people up or that could diminish my stature or my authority. Nowadays, we don't practice reciting this, says the Aruch HaShulchan on source number 5. And it seems that this is because those who learn in the Beit Midrash, there's a typo there, are not issuing halakhic rulings, and the Rav who does issue halakhic rulings isn't in the Beit Midrash. So if you never enter the Beit Midrash to issue a ruling, so the moment that this tefillah might become obligatory to you won't actually happen. It's worth noting that this argument of the Aruch HaShulchan, to justify what is, I think, a pretty common practice, I think, by and large, in my yeshiva experiences, I did not see people reciting this tefillah. But even so, this seems to be a little bit more applicable to the tefillah in advance, Right? The tefillah you say before is about halachic rulings and not making mistakes. The tefillah you say afterwards is to thank Hashem for being someone who sits and learns and doesn't have any relevance to halachic ruling. So even if we accept this argument, it seems more appropriate that when you finish learning, you should say something like this. And I think it's not a coincidence that during a siyum, you do say something like this. Because this version of the tefillah was incorporated. Yeah?
Don't you think of bracha before you do the action?
So that, right, that's true. And I do say bracha to Torah every day. Right? There are bracha before Torah learning. This particular tefillah, he's arguing, you don't need to say because it's not actually for you. And it's not for me. It's for Rav Moshe Feinstein, when he sits down before he starts answering his phone and answering everyone's questions, he should have a tefillah that says, I'm not going to make any or Hashem, help me not make any mistakes. But it actually wouldn't be relevant for someone who's sitting and learning in a normal, lower-stakes context, which most of us do. Sort of, right, sort of like a hinani, or sort of like a hi ratzon, all of these things that maybe would be appropriate under certain circumstances, you know, when you're the one carrying the weight for everyone else, but not necessarily for every individual, right?
And we don't say a brach at the end of learning because you never stop learning.
So
the obligation is until you go to bed.
I mean, so a formal bracha we don't say when you finish learning, but this tefillah sounds like you're meant to say when you finish learning. Correct. Right. There's no formal bracha for I'm finished learning for the day, and right, the idea of I say a bracha before I do something is usually applicable in those contexts. Okay, we'll try to sort of briefly at least outline some approaches to our second question. We probably won't be able to see them fully inside. So the second issue we wanted to deal with is what is the relationship between this tefillah and the other tefillah mentioned in this chapter? And I think to just best get an appreciation of this, we'll skip sources 6, 7, and 8, which are kind of foils for this analysis, and jump straight to the Mishnayot, as they're summarized in source number 9. These are the first four Mishnayot of our chapter. And if you pay attention to either the structure of the chapter or some particular key words, you get the sense that we're almost playing with two different kinds of tefillot in this parak. Right? You look, for example, in the first Mishnah, the one that you spent a lot of time so far in these sessions with, you see formal tefillot. They're designated by times of day, you know, very rigidly, ad arba shaot, sheva shaot, even kol hayom, but it's still being defined specifically by time. It's very rigid and formal. And immediately afterwards, we have the tefillah of Rabbi Nechonia ben Hakana, which is much more fluid, much more situational, all to the point where we might not even think it's necessarily obligatory because he's kind of personalizing it. Halacha Gimel, or Mishnah Gimel, we jump back to formal tefillah. Rabban Gamliel says, B'chol yom mitpalel adam shmona esrei, there's a formal text of 18 brachot, or maybe as Rabbi Yoshua says, me'ein shmona esrei, you know, sort of analogy to 18 brachot, but at the end of the day, some kind of rigid sense of what you're meant to say, what kind of text you're meant to engage with. And by Mishnah Daled, we're ping-ponging back again. And now we have Rabbi Eliezer saying that if your tefillah is fixed and rigid, then it's not fully acceptable. It's not a successful tachanun, a supplication of Hashem for your help. If it's keva, if it's rigid, it doesn't achieve its desired purpose. And so in the structure of the chapter, we see this kind of balance between tefillot reflected. On the one hand, the formality and the rigidity of having tefillot at set times with set texts or set themes. And on the other hand, every other Mishnah is a Mishnah about a personalized prayer and a personalized situation as being very different from these kinds of formal tefillot. It's reflected a little bit in the vocabulary as well. In Mishnayot Bet and Mishnah Daled, you have tefillah katsara. It's not a tefillah, it's a shortened tefillah. And it's not defined by time, but in each Mishnah we talk about a makom. Ma makom l'tefillah zo. Or if you go to a makom zakana, well, in these situations, I have tefillah that are appropriate responses. So in Mishnayot 1 and 3, we have Mishnayot defined by time that are sort of objective responsibilities no matter where, no matter when. And the same text is already fixed. On the other hand, we have a personalized set of tefillot as well that are subjective, that meet me in my particular circumstance, and are suited exactly to my particular needs. There's a lot more to say in trying to unpack some of these themes, which we don't have time for, so I won't hold it. The one resource I would recommend, if anyone has access to it, is a really excellent essay in this book, Nishmat HaMishnah, The Soul of the Mishnah, by Yaakov Nagin. It's accessible and very accessible language, and draws on a lot of literary insights into studying Mishnah. So not Mishnah as a way to get to the Gemara, but just looking at the structure of Mishnayot, like I sort of briefly did here, and drawing out some of these themes. I would help understand the relationship between these tefillot. In particular, I guess to conclude, with the last source on the last page, the Meiri, in page number 8, sort of gives voice to this idea very clearly, even one step further than the Rambam did in the end of that Perek Yud in Hilchot Brachot. The Meiri says, Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana taught with this Mishnah, that each person needs to innovate tefillah in each matter in which he sees he needs divine assistance. L'chadesh tefillah al kol davar. It's one step further than recognizing that you need to thank Hashem in a variety of circumstances, but when you see a circumstance that for you is a moment of personal tefillah, that in this situation I know I need Hashem's help, so you need to innovate and generate that tefillah. And he's exactly giving voice to that idea by contrast to formalized tefillah. So lest you learn the entire fourth chapter of Brachot and think that the only kind of prayer that exists is the formal prayer that we do in shul with the fixed times and forms and places, this Mishnah, Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana's whole teaching, is trying to teach you that there's a whole other world of tefillah to be connected to. The personal, the situational, the kind where you just feel, I need to ask Hashem for something or thank Hashem for something right now in this very moment. I think that dynamic and that balance is what's being reflected in the structure of the entire, in this chapter.
Bottom line, Rabbi, is there a